So I'll do it. And then do you need anything else?
No.
Okay. All right, welcome. Come on in. We want to get started. Those of you who were at the first service will, and where is everybody? Got to go stir them up. Those of you who are at the first service will recognize Dr. Stephen He was with us, opened God's Word. If you are coming to the second service, be prepared. God feeds us richly through Stephen this morning. Stephen is a friend of mine for probably 8 to 10 years now. We keep meeting in random places. We first met in St. Louis. We spent some time together in Boston. Most recently, met again at Mount Fuji, kind of unexpectedly. But so glad to have him here. Represents so much of the things that we care about with regards to missions and this missions emphasis week. You know, thinking about responding to God's call. Stephen is a great student of God's Word. Educated all over the place. I could never give you a full CV on him. It would take the rest of the hour. Just really had opportunity to teach in various places. So he loves God's Word. He is missional both locally and globally, planting a church in Boston, which is not hometown for him, but has become his home, very dedicated to place. So encouraged by that. And then he's been involved in Redeemer City to City work. He is transitioning to be involved more and more with the Gospel Coalition's work in Asia, the Asia Pacific area. So gets a chance to see what God is doing in broad areas of this world. He's a father, he's a husband to Kathleen, he's got three children, a little bit older, the youngest is a junior in high school. Most of all, though, he's a person that has been transformed by the gospel, like a lot of us. We know what it's like to be apart from that, and then we know what it's like to really receive and understand in whatever limited way God allows us to understand that, you know, what it's like to be ravished by the love of God and to have that be our motivation as we go forward. So we've invited him here just to be with us, preach for us, but then also during this time to share a little bit about some of the things that he sees as he goes around the world. So Stephen, come on, and let's get to know you a little bit better.
Thanks, brother. Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah.
So rather than giving a presentation, I thought I'd tell you a little bit about what I do, and then maybe engage in a Q&A session if you had any interest in doing that. The verse that has resonated a lot in my heart for the work that God has called me to do locally, nationally, and globally is the verse in Psalm 40, verse 5, that says, "You have multiplied, O Lord my God, your wondrous deeds and your thoughts toward us. None can compare with you. I will proclaim and tell of them, yet they are more than can be told." So that's pretty much been the testimony of my life, having grown up in this country and having had the privilege and the pleasure of being in so many great cities throughout the world. There's something very beautiful about learning about different cultures. Remember that our experience in the new heavens and the new earth will be a transnational worship experience where God's people from every tribe, tongue, and nation will be gathered for us to be able to worship. And even though this particular community might be a little bit more homogeneous racially, that we are part of because of the trends of globalization and urbanization to a work that God is doing in some remarkable ways around the world. As you know, in the year 1800, less than 2% of the world's population lived in urban centers. In the year 1900, about 10 to 12%. And now we're looking at about 55% of the world's population lives in what we will consider dense urban areas. And in the year 2050, it'll be over 75%. So our future is an urban future, whether we want to accept that or not. Now, this does not mean that rural places or ex-urban communities are not important, because sometimes people get so caught up in this city movement that that people in some ways are drawn in an idolatrous way to the attraction of doing ministry in a city because it seems a little bit more glamorous. But I always say that the gospel is needed, church plants are needed, churches are needed wherever there are people, excuse me, and there are a lot of people in cities. You might not be aware, but by the year 2035, that's less than, what is that? That would be 17 years from now. China's urban population will be 350 million. I mean, granted that the government is forcing the issue and they have the numbers and the power and the authority to do so, but that's larger than the population of our country. You know that the largest English-speaking country in the world is not the United States, right? And of course, it's not Canada. There aren't that many people living in Canada, but it's India. Probably in another 30 years, it will be China because everyone in China is learning English. So that's just the world is changing. I remember when I was bringing my three daughters, they're 24, 21, and going on 17, and when I brought them to Seoul, South Korea, that's where I was born. I was raised in this country, but they were born. My daughters were born here in the Boston area, so they had never seen South Korea or been to Seoul. And because they grew up in the city, we live in the center part of the city of Boston, that they love cities. And they said, "Hey, Dad, what's Seoul going to be like?" And I said, "Well, you girls love the city, and they really love New York City. And so imagine New York City, as dense as New York City, as large as New York City, as populated as New York City, but five times cleaner and more modern, that's Seoul." And so for some of you who are older, right, let's say those of us in our 60s and maybe close to 70, the only recollection that you have of South Korea might be the Korean War, or whatever you've read up on it, or remember MASH. Some of you remember MASH? Not a good representation of my racial heritage, but Seoul is a very, very modern and globalized and sophisticated city, and people, young people especially, they get amazed that there are cities like that in Asia. But the point is that there are 35 mega regions in the world with a population over 10 million. So one major mega region in the United States would be Boston, New York, Philly, D.C. That's considered by modern urbanists as one major mega region. So we no longer think of cities as a metropolis, right? We used to use that language about 20, 30 years ago, but now we think of them as megapolises, right? It's just a mega region. And if we have the technology that the Japanese have created, I don't know if you follow these things, but you know, we have a decent rail system in the Northeast, right? Amtrak, Acela. And the reason why the trains don't go very fast is not because of the lack of capability of the engine of the trains. It's that the rails are not equipped to handle the high speed, right? So Acela, they say, "Oh, yeah, we can go as fast as 125 miles per hour or whatever." Yeah, for 8 seconds. That's all they're doing because the rails are old and you can't go at that high speed. Most of the time it's going around 90, 95. And so, but there is a system that the Japanese have created. It's called Maglev technology. So the trains don't go on. It does not make physical contact with the rails, right? It's levitating on the rails, so less resistance. And so so I think that they said that it can go up to speed 450 miles per hour, okay? Which means that from this urban corridor of Tokyo, Nagoya, and Osaka, right, Kobe, that you can go from Tokyo to Nagoya, which would take about 6.5 hours if you were to drive. It can get there in 42 minutes, which would mean that I can live in Boston and commute to New York, because my commute, if I'm on the Maglev train, will take 18 minutes. Okay? The world is changing. And so the world is becoming smaller because everyone is gravitating towards cities, and you've got these mega urban areas. And again, this is not to say that rural or suburban or exurban communities are unimportant. It just means that as the culture goes, as the city goes, so goes the wider culture, right? And of course, if you, I don't know what your assessment of Boston is, right? And we're playing in a playoff game today. And I was trying to make some sort of a connection with the state of Michigan. And our quarterback, the GOAT, known as the greatest of all times, he is an alumnus of an institution of higher learning here in Michigan. He is an alumnus of the Wolverines in Ann Arbor. I know that's in eastern Michigan, but it's still part of this state. But Boston is a what I like to call a small city with a big bark, right? So people tend to think that Boston, in terms of its population size, is like top 10. It's not. It's around 18. Larger cities like Dallas and Phoenix, even though they might have less social capital, because Boston, because of its hospitals and our institutions, have that kind of influence that other cities might not have because of higher learning. But nevertheless, in terms of its population, it's not as densely populated as some of these other modern cities, right? Boston is more of an older historic European city. And so my burden and the movement that I've been a part of called City to City Global is a ministry that seeks to do three things. So our hedgehog principle, right, kind of the emphasis that we have, three things: gospel, cities, and movements. So we go to all the different world-class cities in the world, which we have targeted, and we go and we recruit, we train, we coach, we mentor, we help fund church plants in these respective cities. That will embrace a gospel DNA, a gospel centrality, that the leaders and the people will not merely believe the gospel, right? If you were to go to any Christian church, you say, do you believe? I mean a Christian church, right? Because there are a lot, like in my city, that might have a name of the church in the name of their association. But it's not a church, right? Because they don't believe the gospel. But a real Christian church that believes the gospel, it's not necessarily guaranteed that those churches will be shaped by that same gospel. So that is, that you might have, as I know from your pastor who preaches grace-centered, Christ-centered sermons, you might have that in the pulpit, but if you have a children's ministry where you have teachers who are telling them, be like Daniel and be like Abraham, and really? Be like Abraham, like in Genesis 12, lying to Pharaoh about his wife. Oh, and then again, he replicates that to Abimelech, to the leader of the Philistines in Genesis 20. And then his son learns that, and he does that in Genesis 26. You mean be like Abraham like that? So if you have a Christ-centered, gospel-centered way of preaching and teaching, but yet every ministry in the life of the church is not shaped by the gospel, then that means that not every dimension of the life of your church is shaped by the gospel. The gospel has to shape everything. You can't have grace-centered teaching and then have moralistic approach to missions. You can't do that. And so the work that I've been doing in the last 10 years, I've done work primarily in China. And 2 years ago, I got a 10-year visa. So I was like, wow, I guess they don't mind my going over there. I remember one time when I was in Beijing with one of my associates from New York, Mark Reynolds, and we went there, and we had the two most high-profile house church leaders in the Beijing area, and they were meeting in the same place with two Westerners, training them with something. Not a good idea. I don't know who planned it like that, but we were there, and all of a sudden we have somebody who's coming up from the stairs and saying, "You gotta get out of here," because the officials are coming, and they heard what we're doing. And so, I mean, I've never been more scared in my life. And so I'm running out of the hotel and just trying to find my way back. I'm running out of that hotel to find my way back to the other hotel. And then Mark was doing the same. And even to this day, I blame him and say, see, can't hang out with a white guy. Being in an Asian city, you know, at least I can kind of disguise myself. And I'm somewhat tall as an Asian, say I come from Yao Ming's district or something. But and so we've been doing this work, and God has allowed me to have access to go there. I've trained over 2,000 pastors in China in the last 10 years, and we had the largest gathering of Christian leaders and pastors in Hong Kong, because all they need is a permit to get to Hong Kong, not a visa. So about 3,500 pastors this past year. It's remarkable. You know that China is the largest Christian country in the world, right? We don't know the figures, right? And experts out of Princeton say it's maybe 80 million, possibly 100. But we're not talking about the Three Self Church. We're talking about the genuine remnant house churches that believe the gospel. And so I've been there. I've been in Tokyo with your pastor in Mount Fuji. I wish that we had trained more indigenous leaders. Like 80% of them were missionaries, Westerners. And that was okay. But Japan, the largest city in the world, 35 million, one of the most sophisticated, but less than 0.5% Christian. Incredible. How did that happen? Why did that happen for Japan, but yet Korea has the kind of Christian population that it has? And by the way, talking about Korea, that's my ethnicity. If I were to ask you, what do you think the percentage of Christians is in South Korea? You probably would say something like, oh, here, 30, 35%. It was never 35%. You know, numbers get inflated in non-Western cultures. And probably at its peak, about 15, 17 years ago, it was about 26%. And that's still an impressive number. But right now, it's at 16% and declining fast, really fast. Some people get shocked when I tell them that there are more 20-somethings in the city of Manhattan who attend church than 20-somethings in the city of Seoul. Really? With all the mega churches in Seoul? Yes. Because 20-somethings are being secularized, right? The forces of secularism. They're just like any other 20-somethings living in world-class cities. They have more in common with one another than they do with even a neighboring exurban community 20-something individual who's 30 miles away. And so, because they have the same aspirations, they're influenced by the same forces of secularism. And so New York is 2.7, Seoul is 1.7, and Boston is 1.4. Okay? So this is the forces of secularism. But yet at the same time, we see God doing remarkable things. So we are now in the city of Seoul with our team. And Keller will be there for the very first time, so I'll be there speaking at a conference with him. We'll probably have about 8,000 people, you know, a medium-sized crowd. And he'll be doing a kind of evangelistic rally, and then we'll be training about 1,700 pastors. Now, that's remarkable because, remember, like a mega church, Seoul has more mega churches than any other. And I'm just mentioning that not because I want to boast on behalf of South Korea, because oftentimes mega churches, not all, and I don't want to demonize all of the good work that God has done or the wonderful and faithful people and churches in Korea, but they're really caught up in the whole church growth movement. They want to know how to grow their church. So when they come to a conference, we tell them, hey, this is not a pragmatically driven ministry. We are driven by the gospel, and we want a robust theological vision that will inform your ministry. And then, like, half of them won't come back the next day, right? Because they want to know, how can I grow my church from, you know, 2,000 to 5,000? And so there isn't much that the Western church can show them, right? What's Keller? Yeah, Keller, yeah, you know, he used to pastor a church of, you know, 5,500 people. Yeah, I've got 40,000. And so what we're doing is that we're going there and telling them, listen, that up to this point, a lot of the churches here in Seoul have been driven by a soft legalism and a moralism that's rooted more in Confucianism than the gospel. Now, I'm not doubting that they're not Christian, but there's a lot of soft legalism. And on top of that, now you have another group of Christians that are just being drawn to easy believism, right? So you got one on the one easy believism and another one that's involved in soft legalism. And so we're trying to tell them, no, I think we need to recapture the heart of what it means to be a Christian, and that's the gospel. And so I've been training for the last 4 years, hundreds and hundreds of pastors in knowing how to preach Christ-centered sermons, rather than just saying, you need to do this, don't do this, do this. And I tell them, yeah, the Bible has all sorts of moral injunctions and prohibitions, but that needs to come after you deliver the gospel. If it comes before you deliver the gospel, then you're just addressing the will, and you won't have real heart change. You need to introduce the gospel, show them that they aren't able to do this, but the gospel of grace and the work of Jesus Christ now enables us and gives us the freedom to be able to live a life of obedience and discipleship. And so that's what we've been doing. But all the work that I've been involved in, whether it's Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, I haven't been to all the Asian cities. City to city goes to Jakarta, goes to Manila, goes to Hong Kong, Taipei. I'll be in Taipei in May. And some remarkable work that God is doing. And what I'm encouraged to see is that there is a hunger. There's a hunger not only for the Word of God, but hunger for a ministry approach that is rooted in the finished work of Jesus. Whereas in the Western world, I don't know if you're aware, but in Christendom here in the United States, people are trying to move away from the centrality of Christianity, which is the gospel, and they want to talk about peripheral issues, even though those peripheral issues are very, very important, like issues of justice and mercy. I just finished writing a book on mercy, so it's not like I'm against mercy. I'm not somebody who says, hey, let's not engage the culture. Right? Just wrote another book on Micah, and it's all about social oppression and justice. So these things are important. However, if it's not rooted in the gospel, then it's a secondary issue. We can't just rally and say, this is what we ought to be about. No, the church ought to be about the mission of the church. And the mission of the church is the Great Commission and the Great Commandment, by the way. It's not just the Great Commission. And teaching them all things that I have taught them. What are all those things? You can't get any more central than the teaching of the Great Commandment, right? So it's not just about go and make disciples, but it's also about teaching them what it means to live a life of discipleship, what it means to engage the culture and to engage in works of justice. So don't think that, oh, either I'm going to be in this kind of wing of the Christian community where we focus on the word and only issues of inner piety, or we're going to be part of a progressive group over here. Well, that would be to your left. Progressive group over here that is engaged in issues of justice and mercy. Right? I know that's what you observe. You say, oh, look at some of our Christian institutions around here. Oh, they're kind of going down the wrong path, or they're getting secularized. Also, we got to kind of gather the crowd, and we need to become more tribal, and we need to protect ourselves. But again, then you're moving away from the Great Commission. You're moving away from what it means to engage the world with the robust gospel without assimilating and over-contextualizing. Okay? And I believe Christ Church to be that church, as far as I can tell. Right? And you should be encouraged that you're part of this community. You can say, yes, we are committed to the historic, reformed, confessional truths of our ecclesial tradition. And we're very, very proud of that. But at the same time, we're not afraid to engage the culture with the gospel. We're not afraid to care for the poor. We're not afraid to speak into the public square and to be able to love our neighbors, even though they might disagree with us with all sorts of different issues. This is the kind of work that the City to City has been involved in. We tend to say that we want to be a church that is integrated and balanced on four ministry fronts. Not only evangelistic worship, right, which your church does well, and the other one is community development, right? That will be building inner community and discipleship programs and ministering to the needs of your people and the elect and the children of the covenant, all of that. That's great. But conservatives, traditional churches tend to emphasize that, but they're weak on the other fronts. And the other two fronts will be the integration of faith and work and social justice and mercy. And whereas progressive churches, they say, oh, no, we don't need to be all about truthful propositions. We just need to be all about Jesus. Oh, we don't want to be concerned about all that kind of theological jargon and doctrine. We just need to be about Jesus. And you ask them, well, all right, you want to be all about Jesus, then who is Jesus? Oh, Jesus, and then you start getting into theology. So you have a theology, whether you like it or not. Everyone has a theology. The question is whether or not it's biblically consistent or not. If you think that he's just some sort of Galilean peasant therapist, then as opposed to the Savior of the world and the King of his kingdom, then, I mean, we all have a certain perspective. We all have a theology, whether the theology is good or bad. And but they tend to do that part well. They're the progressives. They always use the words of cultural renewal. Right? Let's engage the culture. Let's engage in a dialogue that's meaningful in the public square. But how about having a church that is balanced on all four ministry fronts? I remember one time a journalist from the Washington Times contacted me, Julia Duin, and the only reason why she contacted me because she wanted to talk to me about Tim Keller. But anyway, she contacted me, and I told her, I said, what's your church like? And I said, this is the kind of church that we have. And she said, wait a minute. So you're telling me that you do these two things like traditional churches, but then you do these two things like progressive and liberal churches? So how am I going to categorize you? Am I going to call you a traditional conservative church? Or am I going to? I said, it's okay. We don't need a category. We're just trying to be the church. Right? We're trying to be the church in one of the most pagan. I always wonder why, because Boston is the most pagan. Right? Like we go around with a pagan barometer and just say, oh, yeah, a lot of pagans around here. That's, you know, in terms of biblical illiteracy and in terms of being the most secular, you know. Boston is, right? I mean, the top five or the bottom five, however you look at it, every single city in terms of biblical illiteracy and in terms of being secular is a city in New England, except for Albany. Albany kind of got in there. I don't know how it did, but it got in there along with Boston, Providence, Burlington, Vermont, and Hartford, Connecticut. And it's incredible how skeptics, even in our own local church, to a Reformed Presbyterian, PCA church, complementarian on top of that, right? And not everyone in our church subscribes to complementarianism, but they see that we recognize as a secondary issue, and they still come because they recognize that which is essential to us, although that's an important issue. I'm not saying it's secondary to the session. I'm saying they recognize it as a secondary issue, and they're drawn to the centrality of the gospel and what we proclaim, the historic truths of the gospel. So that's kind of what we've been, what I've been a part of, and now I am transitioning a little bit in creating new international regional chapters in Asia with the Gospel Coalition. So the Gospel Coalition Southeast Asia, and that's primarily English speaking, right? And you might not be aware, but cities like KL, Singapore, and Jakarta, and to a certain extent in Bangkok, all speak English. So so that's going to be primarily an English-speaking chapter, and then Chinese-speaking, mainland China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and TGC Korea. So a lot of exciting things are going on, and it's encouraging for me to see that you are a church that wants to be participating in the activity of God globally. So that's a very encouraging thing, and please continue to have this posture of wanting to learn from others who are different than you are. Okay, as somebody who's not part of this dominant racial culture, even though I grew up in this country, and even though I'm bicultural and bilingual, I'm more proficient in English than any other language. I know a lot of dead languages, but I am fluent in Korean. But you know, you need to know that. For you to appreciate the work of God globally, you need to learn from people who are different than you are. That's a beautiful thing. This is the beauty of the gospel. You know, when our culture says things like, "Hey, you know, we need to just be uniform. Let's be blind to the different colors of of various racial groups, right? I mean, that's like the stupidest thing you can say, right? I mean, that's being so like intellectually naive. What do you mean culturally blind? I'm a certain color, Andrew's a certain color, someone else is a different, we're different colors. So you mean telling me we should just kind of avoid that, right? So what they're trying to do is they're saying, hey, we don't want there to be a lot of differences because differences tend to get us into trouble and we get into conflict. If you've written the great work, and my recommendation to a secular author who's got this spot on is Jonathan Haidt, the book The Righteous Mind, who is a nominal Jew who is bipartisan, who is a distinguished professor out of NYU. I had the privilege to share a platform with Jonathan, a brilliant, brilliant thinker. I view Jonathan Haidt as the next Bloom, right, out of Berkeley in the 80s, right, when he wrote the book, Closing of the American Mind. Haidt is the new Bloom, okay? And he's written the book, The Righteous Mind. Read it. It's so spectacular. He challenges, he's not a conservative. He's kind of a moderate, but he challenges all this kind of secular liberal nonsense that he finds at the university when they're trying to push forth a particular agenda. And so he deals with these sorts of things. But our culture tells us, H-A-I-D-T, Haidt, yeah, H-A-I-D-T, Jonathan Haidt. And he teaches at NYU. And so our culture tells us, and certainly all of our institutions of higher learning will tell us that we need to be all about uniformity. And that is why that the whole confusion about transgenderism has evolved, because it's all about uniformity. So when the Bible, this is how the Bible is so clear on these things. The Bible thinks, God thinks so clearly about these things. He says that I'm not about uniformity. I'm not trying to tell somebody who's white to say, be like an Asian person, or an Asian person to be more like a white person. No, they're all different. They have unique backgrounds and unique racial identities. What the Bible teaches, like in Ephesians chapter 2, no longer dividing wall of hostility, what it's teaching is it's about unity in diversity. That's different than university. That means that you can have people from different cultures coming together and we recognize our differences. We're diverse and different, but we can be unified over a common cause or in a common communion. Whereas uniformity says flatten out all the differences. That's what you have in transgenderism. You have uniformity, not unity and diversity. That's why complementarianism is a beautiful reality. It does not tell a woman, hey, a woman, you ought to be a man. And it doesn't tell a man you ought to be a woman. God has made us unique and special, of course, equal. But equality is not the same thing as equivalency. Okay? So that's why when we talk about women's issues, I'm speaking on behalf of all the women, it's not a justice issue. The Bible doesn't see the whole women's issue as a justice issue like it does about race. It's not a justice issue. It's trying to show the beauty of the equality, absolutely, between the two sexes, but not equivalent. Have a different call, different responsibility. And so in the same way with races, we're looking for unity and diversity. And you know where that word shows up, right? Unity and diversity is university. Of course, we don't have any universities in the world. We have pluriversities, right? But we don't have universities. You don't have one particular discipline that ties in all the other variegated disciplines together. During the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance period, of course, we had that, where you had theology, which was able to tie in everything together. But now you have a religion, which starts from man and not from God. So, I don't know how I got off on that tangent, but just wanted to invoke Jonathan Haidt, I think. So do you have any kind of questions for the work that God is doing? I know why I mentioned that, because I want you to be open to the beauty of all of the differences that God has brought into his universal church, okay? Yes, there are wonderful things that white Americans, or this dominant racial culture, has done, right? I'm a recipient and a beneficiary because there were American and Canadian white missionaries who went to Korea in the late 1800s. And as a result of that, I am where I am. Okay? So I know that heritage, the rich blessing, and that's the beautiful work of God. But things are working differently now. You have China who's planning on sending more missionaries than any other country in the next 20 years. Right? Seoul, Korea is the second largest missionary sending country, which will eclipse the United States probably in a few years. And so the world is changing. Right? Not only the millennials, but the next generation after millennials, for those of you who are children of middle schoolers and high schoolers, they're not millennials. Okay? They're iGens. So if you want to do that, Google iGen and start reading up on that, because you got to be prepared. iGens don't use Facebook. They're like, oh, that's for millennials. Don't use Facebook. Right? They don't need to store anything. They don't like to archive anything. It's for the moment. It's the experience for the moment. That's why they like Instagram and Finsta. If you don't know what Finsta is, then ask your middle schooler, and you better find out what Finsta is, okay? And Snapchat. It's like the way they think is very, very different. And they can appreciate all of the differences, but their problem is that they have now moved on from truthful propositions, and they only want that which is experiential, whatever feels right for me. And that's obviously problematic, because sin always feels right to us. and truth seems very, very foreign. So, anyways, any thoughts or questions? Yes.
Are you defining most world-class cities as Asian? And when you go and train leaders there, are they from just Singapore or just Taiwan? Or, and then how do you approach that culturally, what you're teaching them? Because you talked about there are issues in China, there are issues in Korea that are different.
Yeah. So when I go to Singapore, you know that Singapore is an English-speaking Asian city. So if you want to live anywhere and feel like you can assimilate into an Asian city, that would probably be the best, right? Even though Shanghai and Seoul, everything is in English, but Tokyo is probably the most difficult. Tokyo has always been insular, and they're not open to Western influence. But Singapore is an English-speaking country, city. So a lot of the pastors that I've trained there have been are people who have come from other places, who are there to plant churches. One is one of my friends is Indian, India Singaporean, and another pastor church plant that we support is a South African, so they come from all different places. At least in that area in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur, and in Singapore. Because it's English-speaking. Many of them have received their training from Moore Theological College in Sydney. And then they go back there to plant churches. But most other Asian cities, it will be pretty homogeneous. It will be people who are local leaders, who represent that particular dominant racial culture.
Yeah. There's a lot of hand-wringing about millennials in the U.S. church and how the U.S. church is losing millennials, but the statistics don't really bear that out. There's only a couple, maybe 1 or 2 percentage points drop over the last 20 years or so. But you said secularization is having a big impact on the same generation in Eastern Asia. I was wondering why you thought secularization is having a bigger statistical impact in East Asia than it is in the United States.
Not necessarily more, but the same. Okay, so, but that's a good question. So I would say in Asian cultures, remember, one of my pedagogical mentors was Peter Berger, probably one of the most pioneering thinkers about modernization. Like he talked about postmodernity before postmodernity was postmodernity, and Peter Berger.
Yeah, he was pre-modernity, postmodernity.
Yes, and so he, like for example, his book on the one that he wrote, The Homeless Mind, which was written in the 70s, believe it or not, with his wife. And he essentially said he was making a distinction between traditional cultures and modern cultures. He says traditional cultures struggle with shame, and modern cultures struggle with guilt. Traditional cultures find their identity through their communal affiliation, and modern individuals are more individualistic, right? Closing all the, you know, the American mind sort of thing. And so they find their achievement, they find their identity through their achievement, right? So guilt, so you have dignity and guilt, and with the traditional cultures, honor and shame. And so that's why even up to about 20, 25 years ago, even though you had young 20 modern-somethings in Asia, they were still holding on to some of the influences of their communal corporate culture. Okay, because they still want to honor their parents. But now, because the influence of secularism is so powerful, that they're just kind of essentially pretty much the same. That's, I'm talking about millennials, pretty much the same in every Asian culture. And so they don't necessarily have the burden. So about 20, 25 years ago, they had this kind of the experience that I had in this country being bicultural. I'm like, I struggled with my identity as a Western American. I'm thinking, I'm trying to achieve my dignity through this. But at the same time, I struggled with honor and shame. Oh, I'm supposed to please my parents. Oh, but where do I find my meaning? So I had a kind of a dualistic bicultural existential struggle. And that's what Asians had 20, 25 years ago, but no longer. So they're just pretty much, you know what, this is what I am. I'm a millennial, I'm a modern person, we live in the city of Seoul, everyone has a Samsung Galaxy, you know, they drive our cars, and they have a completely different perspective.
One more question?
So you talked a lot about how the churches, say in Asia and Southeast Asia, are dealing with these cultural norms that are not particularly or specifically Christian. They're not having to adopt that. Here in Grand Rapids, we're dealing with a over-churched region. So as we think about expanding, planting churches, and so on and so forth, our dialogue with the populations that surround us are going to be more doctrinally based.
Mm-hmm.
So we're making a case for Christ, so to speak,
right,
from a Reformed perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than addressing the cultural issues, but we're addressing these sorts of cultural issues, mm-hmm, and then also those millennials and the secularization that's occurring with the young populations,
right,
coming out of Calvin and Hope and a few,
yep,
other places like that.
Mm-hmm.
What's your advice and your counsel on that? I mean,
yeah,
how do we go forward with that perspective?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I would say you need good contextualization, right? So what you need to do is you need to exegete your community to see what's going on. Like Grand Rapids would be very different than Boston. And you exegete the community and you look at the struggles that they have, philosophical, secular struggles that they have. Find a point of reference. And to enter into that, challenge it, and retell it in light of the gospel, right? That's Lamin Sane, the Yale theologian, essentially where Keller kind of stole his stuff. Keller steals stuff too, you know. Even though we always, if it sounds good, we're like, oh, Tim must have said it, you know. So he gets credit for things he didn't even say now. So Lamin Sane said that you need to enter into a particular worldview, and then you need to challenge it, and then destabilize it and retell it in light of the gospel. But we as Christian leaders and thought leaders, we're not good at that. We just tend to just kind of challenge. And if you challenge, you're not finding a point of reference. You're not identifying, and you're not able to communicate in the vernacular and translate what you're thinking, the big theological ideas, in a language that is receivable. Okay? Now, don't mishear me. I am not saying that we ought to de-biblicize our vocabulary. That's not what I'm saying. If only Christian leaders would use Christian and biblical vocabulary, you know, call sin, sin, and Christ, Christ, and all of that. It's just that they use a Christendom language. They use tribal language. That's not necessarily biblical, and that's not helpful. And so, but you'll find a point of reference for a Christendom community such as this, on top of that, a reform with a Dutch influence here in this area, then you can invoke. You know, you can invoke the Van Hoosers and the Van Gemmerens and the Herzmans and all that, and they can still kind of adjust to that. But good contextualization, that is finding a point of reference and restabilizing the message of the gospel, that will address a point of reference.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Let's show our appreciation. So those of you who are just coming in for the second service, you get to hear Dr. Stephen for the preaching for the second service. And
A lot to think about, a lot of really challenging ideas for us to mull over. So thank you for that, and you're dismissed.